The case typically starts with a cold call, where the professor selects any student at random. You never know what the question is going to be or whom the professor is going to call on. You have to be prepared to answer, no matter what. And just my luck, I was off in the cold call. As I said, most of my classmates were men in their late 20s to mid-30s who had spent half a decade to a decade working in consulting or private equity. With years of experience speaking up in meetings with clients or partners, speaking up in class at HBS was a breeze for them. They were confident and well-spoken, not shy about voicing their opinions. It sometimes seemed like they'd hardly even read the case study, but that didn't prevent them from sharing their impromptu thoughts anyway, spouting out their theories of what went wrong and what they would do to turn things around. Meanwhile, I dreaded the moment when the professor might call my name. I would have read every single word of the case, but I wasn't as experienced in sharing my opinions and responding to follow-up questions. I found myself shrinking in my chair in hopes that the professor wouldn't see me. My natural shyness came back in full force. I'm by nature a doer, not a talker. I prefer to prove my value through actions, not words. But there are times when you have to speak up, and speak confidently. HBS was going to be a place where I had to learn to find my voice. I didn't like it at first. I wished that I could just be judged on projects and test scores, like before. I struggled with this new way of having to prove myself. But I know now that it was the most important lesson I learned at Harvard, and it has served me every single day in the years since I graduated. Learning how to get people to value what you bring to the discussion is essential, whether you plan to launch your own business, are applying for a job, or have dreams of being a TED Talk superstar. You have to learn to be an effective communicator to succeed. It may not come naturally. That's okay. There are ways you can develop the skill set, just like any other. You may never love having to speak in front of others, but commit to being proficient at it and not letting the fear keep you from pursuing opportunities that could be accelerators for your career. I soon developed a strategy where I could feel confident and ready to share my thoughts if the professor were to call on me. I continued to do the work of reading the case thoroughly. That wasn't the issue. It was dealing with the semi-stage fright that would emerge when my name was called. I had to confront that empty space, that silence with all eyes on me, and be prepared to speak up. So the night before class, after studying the case study inside and out, I would write down on a note card the three main points that I took away from the case. I would write them down word for word. Then I would have talking points ready that I could potentially say in class the next day in case I was subject to the cold call. It felt good to be prepared, to know that if I was called on, I knew exactly what to say. The next time the professor called on me and I had my 3 points ready, I spoke up clearly and confidently. I even took a pause in order to give the illusion that I didn't have every single word already written out. But it soon got to the point that if the professor didn't call on me, considering all the time I'd spent preparing, I would push myself to raise my hand to offer my points to the discussion. I was hyper-prepared. I knew that whatever I had to say would add to the discussion. That gave me enough confidence to raise my hand and provide insights in each class. Step by step, I was able to overcome my fear of speaking up and my concern that I didn't have anything to offer to the discussion. I had developed a skill that would serve me incredibly well in the years to come. The ability to present on my feet and be able to showcase whatever opinion or perspective I had with supporting evidence or rationale, and to know without a doubt that my voice was valid. Secrets to speaking in front of others with confidence. In the past year alone, I was asked to speak about Mogul over 200 times. What was once my biggest nightmare, however, has become a pleasant part of my everyday. To overcome my fear of public speaking, I developed key steps to help boost my confidence when sharing my voice. If this is a challenge you face as well, follow these key steps to master speaking in front of others. Number 1. Write down the central ideas or thoughts that you wish to share. If you're particularly new at public speaking, you may need to write these ideas out word for word like I used to. Practice reciting them over and over until the words roll off your tongue. Then, for the meeting or speech, simply write down several key words that remind you of each main idea in order to jog your memory, worrying less about the exact words to use and more about the message you're trying to communicate. Number 2. Focus on looking the audience in the eye instead of staying focused on your notes. I would locate one person, someone kind-looking or smiling, in each part of the room, with whom I would subsequently make regular eye contact. This would in turn make me more at ease. Number 3. Take your time speaking, pausing as necessary. I had a tendency to speak quickly during cold calls initially, in a rush to get over the pain. I realized that enunciating and speaking with intent made me appear more certain of what I had to say and thus made the audience feel more certain of what I had to say too. Number 4. Learn to add gestures that match your words. I would count off with my fingers if I was making points 1, 2, and 3, which added energy and displayed further confidence. If you are unsure of whether you are coming across clearly, practice your talking points before your presentation, class, or board meeting. You can even videotape yourself on your phone and identify where there are places where you aren't speaking loudly enough or don't talk with enough conviction. Speaking in front of people is a skill that must be practiced. It very rarely comes naturally, but is something that people work at and dedicate time to perfecting. But just remember that the more you do it, the easier it gets. I am living proof of that. Break down boundaries. Unfortunately, we as women aren't often taught how to speak up, or that we should. Or we've internalized messages that in order to succeed in a male-dominated workplace, we must emulate men and erase all evidence of femininity. That we can't be our true selves. This leads us to shy away from positions of influence and impact. In the absence of females in leadership positions, we face a gendered socialization that teaches that politics and positions of leadership are reserved for men. For example, despite making up more than half of the population, in the U.S. House of Representatives, women occupy just 19% of the 435 seats. In the Senate, the number is 21%. Women fill just 23.7% of statewide elected executive offices. And in the private sector, of the 500 companies on the 2016 Fortune 500 list, only 21, a mere 4%, are headed by women. As Marion Wright Edelman famously said, "You can't be what you can't see." Marion Wright Edelman was a young African-American girl growing up in the South in the 1950s. "All the external message of the South told me that I wasn't worth much," she said. "But I didn't believe it because my mother and father always made me believe that I could be anything." She took that belief to heart and went on to become the first African-American woman to pass the Mississippi bar in 1961. As she watched poverty continue to devastate the South, even after the Civil Rights Act of 1964, she created the Children's Defense Fund, the first lobby devoted to children. In fact, the Children's Defense Fund is where one of the first female U.S. presidential candidates went to work after law school. Perhaps the seeds that she could be the first female president were born from Hillary Clinton watching a woman as determined to break down barriers as Marion Wright Edelman. We need more women in leadership positions to show young girls that they can be leaders, they should be leaders, that they were born to be leaders. But even when we make inroads, women leaders are less likely to be celebrated. Nancy Pelosi became the first female Speaker of the House in 2007, but was not featured on the cover of any national news magazine for her entire 4-year run. John Boehner, when he was elected to that position in 2010, was on the cover of 5 in his first 2 weeks. Since the 2016 U.S. presidential election results, we have begun to see an uprising of women willing to run for office across the states. We have realized that we have to be the ones breaking down boundaries and demolishing the stereotypes. Condoleezza Rice once said, "You can't wait for role models to look like you." If Sally Ride, the first female astronaut, had been waiting for a female astronaut role model, she would have never done it. Just because it hasn't happened yet doesn't mean it's impossible. We have to ignore the years of socialization that say that women can only be certain things. We created Mogul to be a place where you know that your voice is worthy and that we want to hear from you. Any user can post material because we wanted women to enter the discussion, not be passive observers, but realize they can contribute themselves. Being a user of the platform allows you to realize that you have a voice that the world needs, that what you have to say matters. The more you value your voice, the more you will realize how much you have to offer the world. The more you will be willing to pursue leadership positions and not worry about feeling out of place. And when you come across a barrier that does try to limit you, diminish you, or belittle you, you'll know that together, our voices can demolish it. Battling unconscious bias. But sometimes, even though you know your voice is valid, there are variables in effect that limit your success. At HBS, the top 5% of the class earns a distinction called the Baker Scholar, an honor that was known to open numerous doors. But in 2009, a year before I entered, just 14% of Baker Scholars were women, despite the fact that they made up almost 40% of the class. No one could understand why this was happening. It wasn't that Harvard was admitting lesser candidates to bulk up the number of women. Women were admitted with the same test scores and levels of experience as men. Given that 50% of your grade at HBS consists of your class participation grade, the administration began to wonder if it was due to the fact that women weren't speaking up in class. At the time, professors were trusted to recall accurately who spoke in class, noting in their gradebooks after each session the students who had contributed to the discussion. Most professors at Harvard Business School are male. Just 20% of the tenured faculty is female. Could there be a gender bias involved in recalling which students truly spoke up in class? In 2013, a year after I graduated, when the majority of Baker Scholars continued to be male, HBS decided to add stenographers to the classrooms so professors would no longer rely on possibly biased memories of who said what. And with that simple addition, it became clear. It wasn't that women weren't speaking up. It was that the professors were more likely to remember the men. Women were receiving lower grades because of the unconscious bias of their professors. After the addition of stenographers in the classroom, the percentage of Baker Scholars who were women increased from just 11% in 2009 to 38% in 2013, a number that closely mirrored their representation in the overall class. It is impossible for us to determine how this kind of gender bias affects women across the board, not just in schools and universities, but when they are considered for promotions and job opportunities. I wish I had an easy solution to help you deal with other people's biases. The fact is, we can't control what other people remember, but we can do our part to address the issue by helping people to become more aware of how we are each unconsciously biased and how this is reflected in our day-to-day actions, and then work to overcome those biases. That is an important part of Mogul's mission. By developing trainings in collaboration with business leaders and experts on unconscious bias as well as inclusive leadership, Mogul has become a leader in ensuring gender equity in the workplace. It trains hundreds of thousands of business leaders across Fortune 1000 companies and more on what biases they may personally exhibit as they review a resume, conduct an interview, or assess promotions, for example. Companies want, just like Harvard Business School, to do better and be better. They just weren't equipped with how to do it until now. Remain your authentic self. I know that we won't be able to solve these problems overnight, but my hope in creating Mogul was to address many of them, to show you that you can become a mogul and that you can pursue success and significance just as much as anyone around you, and do so by remaining your authentic self. At HBS, my classmates and I often discussed the spectrum of female stereotypes. On one hand, if you were too warm and kind, you were likely to be viewed as incompetent. On the other hand, if you were cold and unemotional, you were likely to be viewed as mean but competent. It was a lose-lose situation. Why did this have to be the case? I opted to just be myself. But I continued to wonder about this as I saw some of my classmates begin to prioritize coldness over kindness in order to be taken seriously, erasing all emotionality. I might have eventually bought into that mindset as well, but then I met Stephanie, another woman in my section who wasn't about to change who she was just because of what others thought of her. Stephanie was also not your typical HBS student. An engineering major from Purdue, she looked just like Reese Witherspoon, with long blonde hair, a megawatt smile, and a white miniature dog named Tofu. She, like me, stuck out like a sore thumb in our section. We were both not yet married and known to be sweet, and I could tell that she didn't want to have to change who she was to succeed in business either. During our first week of class, we both offered to help organize the food for our section retreat in the fall. A few hours shopping for 90 people at Costco, combined with our subsequent road trip to Vermont, where we were to set up the food before everyone else arrived, cemented a best friendship and everlasting bond that has seen us support each other through thick and thin, from the classroom to the workplace, through every relationship and more. Stephanie has gone on to become one of the most successful female executives in the healthcare industry. And just like with Diane, my friend from high school, I was a bridesmaid in Stephanie's wedding years later. We still text each other good morning every day. During January of that first year, I went on an HBS trip to Vietnam, where students would have the opportunity to assist various companies in need of business insights. There I met Maya, another business school classmate, who was Lebanese and Greek. Maya graduated in the top 0.5% of her class at the American University in Beirut, and was gorgeous and an international jet setter, quite parallel to the otherwise incomparable Amal Clooney. But most endearingly, Maya was also genuine, frank, and direct. She told it like it was, though she also coupled her remarks with humor, wit, and a charming French accent, disarming her audience and immediately establishing a rapport with them. Seeing her stick to being 100% authentically true to herself was incredibly refreshing and empowering. Still to this day, whenever I have a tough question that requires a tough answer, I will message or call Maya wherever she may be in the world. She will always tell it to me straight, usually while on a plane to whichever city she is headed next. If Stephanie and Maya hadn't been by my side, two other women who weren't afraid to be smart, feminine, kind, and authentically themselves, I might have developed a harder shell and more closely followed the mold set before us. But with each other's encouragement, we strive to not bend to the pressure around us to look or act a certain way. When you help another woman succeed, all women succeed. We are so much stronger as allies, and we need each other to move ahead. I've endeavored to remain my authentic self throughout my professional life so that we can try to change the perception. We don't have to be cold and unemotional to be taken seriously as women in business. In fact, strong feminine leadership is highly coveted given its remarkable results. Need an example? Tech startups that have a female executive average a 35% higher return on investment. It is our opportunity to stand together and demonstrate the value of our diverse perspectives, not by acting more masculine, but by continuing to be our kind, competent, authentic selves, for which we should never feel regret. It's true. Times were different not even that long ago. One of my friends told me that it wasn't until she had reached the C-suite of a Fortune 100 company that she felt she could really be herself at work. She had worried that she wouldn't receive the respect that would be necessary for the next promotion. So role after role, and decade after decade, she had put on a more masculine attitude in order to fit the mold that was expected to achieve success in the workplace. Yet as soon as she was promoted to the C-suite, she began to wear more comfortable clothes around the office. She became sweeter, kinder. She became herself. But today, things are beginning to change, and it's up to us to continue that momentum. Being a great leader doesn't mean you have to mimic masculine habits. Having a strong feminine leadership style can lead to the best results. You can lead with compassion and care and get the same or even better results than if you were strict, non-emotional, and demanding. It is up to us to redefine these words and these stereotypes. We've done it with the word mogul. Why not redefine what it means to be a leader? What if a leader didn't mean someone who looked down from above, shouting dictates and orders, but meant someone who came alongside, supported, uplifted, and encouraged? Once we see more women in leadership positions, empowered to be feminine in their leadership style, we will no longer feel like we have to adopt masculine traits to be considered a leader. Even so, at any given moment, you may feel this tension between being who you are and being who you feel the world needs you to be. But it is always better to choose the former. By remaining your authentic self, you'll experience an ease of life. You won't need to expend energy maintaining a mask that was born out of peer pressure or a desire to not stand out. You were meant to stand out. You were meant to have your unique ideas and thoughts and perspectives. You were meant to have the kind of confidence that can only come from being your true and natural self. You were meant to be you. Cultivating confidence. It took me many years and countless times where I kept my mouth shut before I consistently raised my hand, offered my opinion, and stepped into the discussion. If you're feeling like you're the one person who is different in the room, take a moment to recognize that that shouldn't hold you back, but instead encourage you to speak up. This, like everything else, takes practice. If you are facing an industry event, a board meeting, or an interview where you know you will be facing a room full of people unlike you, acknowledge what an important thing you are doing. You are taking one more step for each of us to claim our place at the table. You are saying, there is room here for me too. Take a moment and remember who you are, where you come from, the perspective that you bring. Play in an individual highlight reel of your accomplishments to boost your confidence. Then repeat the following mantras. I will not let other people's stereotypes limit where I can go. We need diverse people and perspectives in the conversation. My perspective is important. I deserve to be here. Communicate constantly, consistently, and clearly. So far, I focused here on my growth as a person during business school, because I do think that facing some of these stereotypes, biases, and conditionings was more important than any one lesson I could learn in the classroom. That said, I did learn a lot in the classroom too, and the lessons I remember most significantly focused on one key theme, communication. One of the most important ideas I got from business school that I use to this day is the concept of repetition, repetition, repetition. I heard this in a class taught by Professor Robert Kaplan. When expressing something to your team members, the first time you say something, they hear you. The next time you say it, they get it. And by the following time you repeat it, they really absorb it. You cannot state your objective just once and hope that someone will so quickly capture all that you intended. You must repeat and repeat to make sure it is understood and never forgotten. I have used that lesson many times in my career and as I built Mogul. Another key lesson that I valued greatly is the concept of goal alignment. If you want your employees to be fulfilled and strive to work even harder, you have to make sure they understand the big picture thinking of the company and that their goals align with the goals of the company. This was what my friends and I most often noted was missing from our work at our respective employers, particularly at the junior level. We frequently saw little connection with how our presentations and number crunching were impacting the goals of the institution as a whole. As a result, work could sometimes become tedious and unfulfilling. If the leaders of the companies we had been at had brought us junior team members more into the fold, By communicating how our work was contributing to the whole, we would have been much more satisfied and more likely to pour ourselves into our work. In the end, it all comes down to communication. You have to communicate with each other to create full buy-in. Let everyone know what you are working toward. The best way to do this is to develop goals together so that the goals aren't coming only from the top down, but are also coming from the ground up. Observe where these top-down and bottom-up goals align and misalign, and communicate and compromise on those points. Being a part of goal-setting creates more buy-in and commitment from your team members. It allows a feeling of camaraderie and shared interest that makes the workplace much more fulfilling for all involved. Communication is also essential if you are co-founding a business with someone. You want to ensure that you are communicating with each other about your individual goals for the company. In business school, during a class on the Founder's Dilemmas with Professor Noam Wasserman, we discussed the challenge that many entrepreneurs face. Do they want to be rich or do they want to be king? If your motive is to be rich, then you will make choices that enable your company to grow as quickly as possible, even if it means giving up some control. If your co-founder, on the other hand, is focused on being and staying king, they prioritize control over cash. They may want to turn down certain opportunities that could lead to explosive growth if it means sacrificing some control of their kingdom. If these goals are not explicitly communicated ahead of founding a company, two co-founders are bound to find themselves facing serious conflict. It remains the reason why 65% of startups fail today. Today, I frequently look back upon my time at HBS to recall these lessons and apply them at Mogul. But more so, I remember how much I grew, how much confidence I gained, and how helpful it was to recognize that my voice was necessary, valuable, and important, so that I was able to share it in every job I had going forward. Hashtag YouAreMogul. You don't need to get a fancy degree in order to have something to add to the conversation. You have a voice that matters and that the world urgently needs. Value your voice, share it often, and step into positions of impact and influence wherever you can. It won't be handed to you. You have to reach for it. Hashtag I am a mogul. By Nina Garcia, editor-in-chief of Elle Magazine and judge on Project One Way. I grew up in South America and came to America when I was 15. I was never going to fit in working in the American fashion industry. My frame of reference for beauty and what a woman should be was shaped by the Colombian culture. But it was that unique background, that ability to see things differently, that helped me rise to where I am today. The fact that I was an immigrant working in America's fashion world gave me a unique point of view. I saw fashion with a different eye, and I always considered that a plus. I truly believed it was a benefit. So in turn, it became beneficial. You have to have that confidence that your voice is valid. I knew I was bringing something different to the table than everyone else, and that distinct perspective that I wasn't afraid to share is what led to my success in the industry. The role of an editor, and that of a creative director, is to give the magazine a point of view, a voice, and a perspective that is all its own. We could not just hope to emulate others. That would have caused us to get lost in a very crowded industry. It is no different for you. You must access your authentic perspective in order to make inroads in whatever industry you want to go into. People need to hear your voice that is different from theirs. You have to be yourself. If you think about fashion and the most inspiring designers, they succeed because they are putting their point of view out into the world in a way that others haven't before. That is the only way to make a name for yourself in fashion. See things differently and dare to put it out there. Fashion, by its very nature, empowers you to express your individuality. That's why I've always said, you don't need to follow the trends. You can make the trends. Whether you are in an industry like fashion that is dominated by females, or in an industry like banking that tends to be dominated by males, have the confidence to be authentically yourself. Develop your own personal voice and style, and it will allow you to truly stand out from the crowd. Chapter 3. Crush It in Corporate Life. Some people are convinced that the path to success is about single-minded determination. You see a goal and you hammer away at it until you achieve it. That wasn't my path, and it hasn't been the path of most of the women in the mogul community. This is, in part, because old career models are fading away. The corporate ladder that was once a straight path up is now old and rusty. It's an exhilarating thought. Most of us won't spend our careers at one company climbing one corporate ladder. We don't have an eye on the corner office because there are no more corner offices. Doors are opening and walls are coming down, literally and figuratively. In fact, recent studies have shown that only 13% of millennials aspire to be the CEO or president of an existing company. By contrast, nearly 70% of millennials hope to start their own business someday. I love the ambition of this generation, but the key word is someday. Very few of us will start a company right after college. Most of us will still spend years of our lives working for other people. And that is a wonderful opportunity. Despite the fact that I always knew I wanted to create my own company, I also knew I had a lot to learn before I was ready to do so. Therefore, I always approached every job I took on as an opportunity to learn a skill set that would help me down the road. Too often, we look for opportunities that will enhance our resumes. Instead of staying focused on, what could I learn here? And will this be an opportunity to experience something new? Even if you are not yet working in your dream job, don't wish these years away. Consider this time in your life your training. This is your chance to learn from the greats, to soak up knowledge and strategies and build up your skill sets while you further refine your passions that will help you determine where your career will go. Olympians don't automatically find themselves winning gold medals. They spend years getting ready to attain greatness, training with the best, developing their skills so that when they step out into the arena, they win the gold. Develop your skills. Not all jobs are equal training grounds, however, so I advise you to think carefully about what jobs you take on. I understand, we all need a paycheck, and sometimes any job is better than no job, but I've always thought first and foremost about how the job offered would provide the skill sets to help me run a media and technology company one day. What skills would it develop in me that could be useful in my career down the road? I felt that to be a business owner, I needed to know every facet of the industry I would be in, inside and out. I needed to be a kind of jack of all trades. Though you might like to just imagine being the leader, getting to call all the shots and make all the decisions, the truth is, to build a company, you've got to initially have your hand in all aspects of the company. Finance, operations, content, marketing, distribution, strategy, business development, branding, product, technology. These skill sets became a kind of checklist for me very early on, and I weighed every opportunity that came my way with whether or not it would help me develop in one of these areas. Perhaps you find yourself in a position where you've never allowed yourself to go after what you truly want. Paying bills and paying off student loans have taken a priority, and that is okay. But I know that the business world today is an incredibly creative place, and there are so many ways you can make an impact in the world. So if you find yourself in a job that does not light you up with passion and joy, I invite you to begin to dream. What is your ideal job? And what are the steps you might take to get there? It may seem like there are a million steps between where you are today and where you want to go, but I hope you have seen by now that there are always accelerators that can get you there much faster. So dream big, and then make choices that will allow you to develop the skill sets to get you there one day. You don't have to know the exact way, you may just have a general idea or direction. And you aren't going to get there immediately, but learn to approach your current situation strategically and acquire as many valuable transferable skills as you can. These days, working for other people should not be wasted. They are golden opportunities. If you don't know your end goal, don't worry. These years can also be a great opportunity to try out different industries and determine your strengths, weaknesses, passions, and ultimately, what you want to pursue. Determining your end goal and what skills to develop. Take a moment to think about what industry you want to be in and what you want to be doing 5 years from now. Then think backward about what you need to learn and know to achieve that goal. Think of specific transferable skills. Then create a checklist, as I did with my checklist of skills, so that you don't get sidetracked along the way. If you don't know what you want to ideally be doing, use the following questions to help get your creative juices flowing and begin to realize where your passions, strengths, and interests lie. What am I naturally good at? What do I truly love doing? What do I really want? What do I really, really want? What is the deeper urge behind that goal? Answering these questions will not only help you determine what you love to do and should therefore do, but get to the root of the kind of impact you truly desire to have on the world. Stay focused on the end goal. It is not like there weren't times when I too questioned whether I was doing the right thing or in the right job. While I learned a lot in finance during those years before business school, the part of me that wanted to make a difference, that wanted my family to be proud of me, was fighting with my current situation, which was spending my days crunching numbers. I just couldn't see the impact I was making and felt discouraged. In fact, though I had just one more year before HBS was to start, I struggled with whether I was on the right path and applied for an unpaid internship at the United Nations. Yet, it wasn't applicable to any of the skill sets I'd wished to learn. When the UN accepted my application, I called my father. I told him why I was thinking about leaving my current finance job for the UN and how much I respected what the UN was doing. But I couldn't get around the fact that if I quit, I would barely have scratched the surface of what I needed to learn in finance for my end goal. In a way, I think I called him that day because I wanted him to tell me I would be making a mistake. And sure enough, that's what he did. "Tiffany," he said, "I know that you want to make a difference, and you will. But right now, you are putting in the hours to learn the skills necessary to make that difference. If you quit right now, you are going to look back and feel like you didn't have a chance to fully round out your knowledge of this area. If you are ever going to pursue starting something, put your heart into it and finish this out. Become the best you can be at it, then move on to the next thing." It was my own cherished philosophy, which I seem to have forgotten. He paused. "The reality is, Tiffany, that one day the UN will invite you, not as an unpaid intern, but as a guest because you will have created something of global impact." My father reminded me of something important that day. Sometimes we have to be patient with our goals. We have to be present in the moment and not always try to fast forward to where we want to go. I turned down the UN internship and finished my time in finance. But not before communicating with my superiors at Credit Suisse about how I hoped to see more of the impact I was having so that I could further pour myself into the work. In turn, they granted me permission to fly to the cities where each of my mergers and acquisitions deals was scheduled to close, from West Palm Beach, Florida, to Jackson, Ohio, to Jena, Germany, so I could see for myself the impact each would have on the company's teams, their management, and the surrounding communities. It helped me to put faces to the company names that I had stared at for so long from my lone computer in New York. And from those trips, I became friends with our clients and familiar with our products, and understood firsthand the impact that could transpire from being adept to finance. It enriched my overall experience, all of which was a great foundation for my subsequent years at business school. By the time I graduated from HBS, I had an offer to work full-time at HBO within their distribution and marketing division, where I had interned the summer between business school years. But I was ready to expand my skill sets further. My finance skill set was on point. I could check that off the list. I developed significant insight on distribution. Could also check that off the list. I therefore accepted a job offer from CBS, where I would help lead strategic initiatives and partnerships for their organization's growth, learning extensively as well as building relationships across the intersection of TV, radio, web, and mobile. That would enable me to develop expertise in operations, strategy, and business development. All that remained were content, marketing, branding, product, and technology. Still a lot to tackle, but I would be well on my way to feeling competent and confident to start my own endeavor. Tips for accepting a job offer. When I first landed job offers early in my career, there weren't enough resources to turn to that would outline how to negotiate for the best salary or terms. Yet another reason for creating Mogul. However, I would always make sure to research industry benchmarks so I knew what was standard in the field, and when I would receive a call from HR with an offer, I would say thank you, make it clear that I was excited about the company and about the team, and that I would consider and reconnect shortly. If I had another offer on the table, I would be sure to be transparent that I had received multiple offers, but I was especially excited for this company. Then I would call back a day later and ask for about a 10 to 20% higher salary as well as a higher role with greater responsibility. That might simply mean adding senior to the title and getting one or two more projects, but I've always viewed that as half a step closer to where you want it to be. Typically, if you ask, you will get more than what you were initially offered, and that was the case for me and CBS. If someone says no to your request, it doesn't mean you can't take the job, but you have asked for what you thought you were worth. And if the reasons why they could not accommodate your request were non-budgetary, you can always begin the conversation of what you need to accomplish in order to eventually get that rate. This way, you accept the job knowing ahead of time what goals you and your company have set so that you can reach that role or salary in the near future. Negotiating your salary is a key accelerator. Did you know that a 2016 Glassdoor study found that 68% of women did not negotiate their salary? That is money that you are leaving on the table. Only 52% of men made that mistake. Don't miss this opportunity. Go in with a goal, and if they aren't willing to match your request, figure out what your BATNA is, or best alternative to a negotiated agreement. In other words, know your answers to these questions. What is the minimum salary that you're willing to accept? And what are the implications if you don't ultimately take what is offered? Calmly reference your other options without your counterpart feeling threatened. If your counterpart is receptive to your negotiation and unwilling to let you walk away, then you'll find yourself meeting somewhere in the middle, and you're still ahead of where you would have been if you had just accepted their first offer. Kill it by over-delivering. There's one skill that I believe will be an accelerator for you no matter what job you find yourself in. One maxim that I believe will guarantee success. One attitude that will carry you exactly where you want to go. I've used it for every single job I've taken on, and it has never failed me. You've got to kill it and over-deliver on every task you are given. And I mean every task. There is no task too small for you. In any job, you want to be focused on how you can be of service in big ways and small. Early in your career or tenure at a company, your tasks may be as mundane as making coffee, scheduling appointments, or answering the phone. But those tasks can be performed impeccably well. Make the best cup of coffee you can, exactly how your manager likes it. Set up a scheduling system that never fails, that allows you or those you work for to know exactly where they need to be at all times. Answer the phone promptly and kindly, and as if a New York Times reporter were watching you and going to write a front-page article about how you answered that phone. A friend of mine once told me that while working for a political campaign, she learned she and her coworkers would have to manually send thousands of letters out, which would require them to staple thousands of papers together and lick thousands of stamps. This must have been before the introduction of self-adhesive stamps. The rest of her coworkers visibly groaned, whereas she rejoiced in the task and became so passionate about licking stamps for that 3-day period that she became the best anyone had ever seen. By the end of the 3 days, she had been promoted, though with a very sore tongue, a small price to pay for making her way up the ranks. You see, the key is not just doing those tasks well, but to go above and beyond what is asked of you. This mindset truly helped me rise faster and take on more at CBS in my 2 years there than I ever could have imagined. When I first joined CBS, I loved being back in New York. I moved into an apartment at 69th Street and Central Park West, and would walk to the CBS offices in Midtown through Central Park. No day was ever the same at CBS, and I relished the fast pace and the freedom that the company gave me to set my own schedule and take on additional responsibilities. Because of the experience I'd accumulated throughout my time at Yale and HBS, as well as within finance and media, I was brought in at a high level and became one of the youngest directors. I was also given a lot of freedom in my job. It was very entrepreneurial, which I loved, and given my own hustler mentality, it meant that I was able to take on more and more. CBS is an enormous entity with a large number of properties. They had TV stations, radio stations, both national and local, and at the time, were trying to figure out how to distribute these properties digitally across web, and mobile app, which were becoming new venues for people to watch content. As director of business development, I was charged with developing and executing new initiatives for growth, such as revenue growth or user growth, which often meant developing strategic partnerships. I often came up with ideas that hadn't been presented before. I would propose to other media organizations that we partner on live events in order to live stream their concerts and encourage sponsorship on our sites. Or if we had video content that wasn't being viewed, I would reach out to these organizations to see if they wanted our content across their channels, thereby increasing viewership for all. I loved being able to support startups in particular. If I championed them internally, CBS would ultimately agree to partner. We would cut them a check, enabling these startups to grow further and faster, while we gained visibility and reach. A win for everyone. And when my superiors observed my ability to take on new projects, come up with creative solutions and over-deliver, they kept giving me more and more responsibility. Developing your hustler mentality. A hustler mentality means you are a fighter who won't stop until you accomplish what you set out to. You are resourceful and willing to roll up your sleeves without relying on someone else. And you are bold and courageous, able to overcome whatever obstacle in order to make that connection, close that deal, or make that opportunity a reality. This mindset is obviously imperative for entrepreneurs, but it also really serves you in any job. When you are a hustler, you become someone that people depend on because they have seen you, time and time again, give your all to every job you are given, and often find unusual and unexpected solutions to problems. Hustlers don't expect to have everything handed to them on a silver platter, from a raise to a promotion to a fulfilling job. They're incredibly driven and showcase moxie, dedication, and commitment. So when you find yourself feeling burnt out in your career, think about how you could apply your hustler mentality to the work you've been given. Is there a way you could make your task more interesting? Think about it in a different way, or suggest something creative to your manager? Discover your differentiator. During my tenure at CBS, I quickly developed a specialty in an area that comparatively few else within the industry had expertise in at the time, digital distribution. This was a new trend in the marketplace. For almost 50 years, content had been primarily distributed via radio, television, or print. But with the rise of not just the internet, but soon thereafter, streaming services and social media platforms, there were thousands of additional channels for distribution. Because of the insights I'd gained while at HBO, developing distribution strategies for their new app, HBO Go, and because there was no veteran at CBS dedicated to this continually evolving realm, it soon became my domain, despite my age and lack of tenure. After just a year at CBS, I found myself overseeing the start of our digital distribution efforts. This accelerated my growth, giving me access to people and meetings I otherwise would not have been exposed to. Find your differentiator, or a skill set that you developed that few others have. This allows you to rise quicker, because you are the only one people can turn to. Being different is good. Use it to your advantage. Unfortunately, instead of finding a differentiator, all too often, people follow others who have found wealth and prestige on one certain path. I saw this mentality at both Yale and HBS. There were certain paths that people tended to go down, even if they would never lead to anything that resembled their true passion. For example, recruiters from companies with structured recruitment programs would always arrive on campus at Yale or HBS in the fall. Students would flock to these recruiters, who offered jobs that both were lucrative and came with a kind of pedigree and reputation people sought. Plus, it meant you had a job offer before Christmas. You'd have the rest of your final school year to relax, knowing your future. At HBS, most graduates ended up taking jobs in the world of finance or consulting, the very two fields the majority of students had initially come from. I was one of the few business school graduates interested in working in media. But when you dare to do something different, it can become an accelerator. My best friend from high school, Diane, shared this mentality. As mentioned previously, Diane was top of our class, one of the smartest girls I'd ever met. She wanted to become a doctor. But while she was at Harvard Medical School, obtaining her MD-PhD, she watched everyone determine their specialties and noticed there were certain areas that people tended to flock to, dermatology and orthopedics, because they offered good pay and decent hours. Or surgery, because it brought with it an aura of prestige, as well as high salaries. Very few doctors specialized in pediatric neurology. But Diane knew that children with neurological conditions needed just as much help as any other sick person. So after graduating from HMS, she went into that field and is an absolute rock star in it. Now, she probably would have become a rock star in whatever field she chose, but because there were so few talented doctors pursuing this specialty, Diane was truly an anomaly and highly in demand. Choosing that specialty was an accelerator for her. I'm not saying that you should only pursue specialties because no one else is doing them. I do suggest that you get creative about how you might apply your passion to a problem or industry in a new way. Don't get caught up in the rat race that says there is one path to success. Find what your differentiator can be, and go after it with all your heart. Become an intrapreneur. An entrepreneur is always looking for new opportunities, new ways to approach a problem, new ways to create revenue no matter where they are working. An intrapreneur is someone who takes the mindset of an entrepreneur and applies it to the company that they work for. This is an extremely valuable skill set in any job. Don't be afraid to show this side of you in the workplace. Every day that I was at CBS, I was always ready and willing to do more and take on more. I jumped at every chance to take on any additional responsibility and create new business opportunities for the assets I helped oversee to further grow and scale. About a year and a half into my tenure, one of the presidents within the company approached me to collaborate with him more directly. I'd received their annual All-Star Award for my work that past year, and he formally offered to further support my development if, in exchange, I would only spend 25% of my time on business development from that moment onward. The rest would be spent shadowing him directly, collaborating on thought leadership and participating in strategic meetings across departments so I could support his decision-making, as well as creating presentations for his own meetings so I would learn how the company was run from the highest level. This was a huge accelerator for me. During that time, I was invited into meetings that I wouldn't have had access to for several years had he not issued this invitation. Because I was in the majority of meetings he attended, I was able to see all the problems and issues that management must regularly address. I could watch firsthand how he handled those problems. I witnessed the pressure sales leaders were constantly under, assessed budget sheets, and essentially soaked up every part of the experience. Most of the jobs he gave me were invigorating and exciting. Some of them were understandably more mundane. But I poured myself into each task wholeheartedly, always asking what I could learn from the task, and of course how I could go beyond what was asked of me. Over-delivering is not something one does to get started in one's career. It is something successful people do throughout their career. Developing your entrepreneurial mindset in the workplace. These tips will inevitably impress those above you. Tip 1. When there is a new project being discussed or you see an opportunity forming where no one else is paying attention, speak up and offer to spearhead that initiative. Don't assume that someone more senior will see the opportunity or volunteer for the job. Always be the first to volunteer in meetings or for taking on new responsibilities. Tip 2. Pay attention to what your manager's highest priority is or what they feel is lacking, and then deliver a solution. They will recognize that you have your priorities right as well. Tip 3. Ask to attend meetings with the people to whom you report. They may say no, but if they say yes, you now have another opportunity to learn and an additional opportunity to volunteer to help. Tip 4. When you are given a job description, go above and beyond. Do what is asked of you, but then think about what else might be helpful. If you have to do something more mundane, trick your mind into believing it is the most exciting thing you have ever had to do. Your positive attitude will make others excited to work with you. Ask for what you want, because no one else will ask for you. Obviously, promotions are essential to rising in the ranks. A promotion allows you to accelerate your stature in your industry of choice and often comes with a pay raise as well. But here is the thing. If you don't ask, you don't get. In a 2015 PayScale survey, 57% of people don't ask for raises, and women are less likely to ask for raises than men. So we have to learn to ask. But we can't just go in with a demand and expect to get what we want. It benefits you to have a strategy in place so that you are guaranteed a yes. Here's what I learned to do. 6 months into any job I had, I would meet with my supervisor and let them know that in the future, I would love to be considered for a promotion or raise. And then I would ask them a targeted question. What is your expectation for what I need to accomplish? And what milestones do I need to hit in order to receive a promotion? Encourage their answer to be as concrete as possible. What would they like to see from you in the next 6 months in order to warrant a promotion? When you get details, you can walk out of that room knowing exactly what you need to accomplish. Then when you go back in for your one-year performance review, you've already hit those benchmarks or goals. It makes them much more likely to say yes to a promotion. You've hit the target already. How could they say no? Make it difficult for them to say no. It may seem crazy to begin asking about such things just 6 months into a job, but I am a firm believer that you cannot just wait for a promotion to come to you. Your supervisors may be focused on their own careers and meeting their own goals. They may not be actively looking to make sure you accomplish yours. You cannot leave promotions and raises to chance. You must be proactive about them. It's important to be in charge of your own destiny. Having your future in your own hands is a position you should always strive to put yourself in. Why wait around for someone else's whim to kick in? Why not enhance your chances by communicating your aim and receiving someone's expectations? This in turn deepens and strengthens your working relationship, as they'll be rooting for you, while also helping you accomplish your goals quicker. It's all about communication and transparency. This is so much bigger than asking for a raise or a promotion. Speaking up is a global issue that women face. When you don't ask for what you want, you don't give yourself the chance to receive it. If there is something that you wish for, voice it. Voice your hopes and opinions. Think of the women who stood up for their right to vote or right to drive in their respective countries, risking their lives to do so. It took years and some arrests and a lot of pain to accomplish their goal, but they are now finally getting the right to do so. In the last chapter, we talked about how to value your voice. Now it is time to use it to ask for what you want. My years at CBS were a huge time of growth for me, a time of acquiring new skills and building friendships with those in the media industry. But it wasn't just my hours inside the office building that helped me understand the ins and outs of running a company. It was just as much the time I spent outside the office after hours that contributed to the company's launch. In the next chapter, we'll talk about the all-important side hustle. Asking for a promotion. Today is the day you set yourself up for promotion. Write down these three